I'd mentioned to you yesterday that Catholics are very likely were not much of a nominalist, but much more a chemist. Also, revealed a strong influence in the study of German mysticism. And on this score, too, Luther continued, or decreasingly, continued to acknowledge his debt to German mysticism in helping him too to break through the Christian gospel. In fact, he was so impressed with one of the standard works of German mysticism, Deutsche Theologie, Theologia Germania, that he himself undertook to have the work published in a big form in 1516 and then in 1519 in its full unabridged version. He read the sermons of Keller, a figure quote. And at one point, speaks of Keller as the greatest theologian Germany had ever produced. But it wasn't everything about German mysticism that seemed to be of service to him. In fact, if you and I were to read the Deutsche Theologie today and then put it down and pick up Luther's theology, you would wonder what he found in common with it. You would wonder whether he wasn't overzealous in his praise of it, whether he wasn't in some way hoodwinked by it. So one of the things that would strike you and me today almost immediately about German mysticism was its tendency toward pantheism. And you don't find this in Luther. That's a discussion by itself. Let's admit that. What was it about German mysticism that became very prominent in Luther's early theological thinking? Well, it was particularly this. The religious man is the man who becomes aware that it is nothing that we do, feel, think, or say, which renders us valuable before God or puts us into communion with God. On the contrary, all that we think, do, or say, all the very content of our lives, the very content of our consciousness, our deeds and our mysteries, our thoughts and our misthoughts, our good feelings and our bad feelings, all of this has to be reduced to absolutely zero. The complete annihilation of the self before God is what is important. And this is expressed in the Desperatio Sui, the complete despair of oneself, so that there is nothing about myself which any longer preoccupies me from the presence of God, and thereby I am emptied of all that is I. For the house has been cleaned and opened entirely for the invasion from the divine. And the converse side of this desperatio theory in German mysticism, where the self is virtually annihilated as it stands before God, is that right on the other side of this despair of self stands God with his graciousness. A man is closest to God's mercy when he is most desperate about himself. When I am weak, then am I strong. You see the abiding influence, for example, of this cat in German mysticism in Luther's, even his mature theology. For example, perhaps you noticed in the 1531 Galatians lecture, which he read last week, that on occasion when he exercises the Son, the psalmist is really only speaking in the person of Jesus Christ. It is Christ, he says, there through the words of the psalmist, out of the depth have I cried unto thee, O Lord, Lord, hear my voice. It is Christ, he says, in the words of the psalmist, my bones are filled to my roaring all the day long. My mercy is turned into the breath of summer. I got in my touch with my tears, as you said this morning in the psalm. Now, this so-called pathological interpretation of the psalm, as you find Luther doing it even in his later years, owes a great debt to German mysticism. It is so particularly to that one feature which I just mentioned, namely that as the man is driven to the depth, he is the closest indeed to God's love. And how was it that Christ bore our sin by himself being driven to the depth, culminating finally in the cry of dereliction, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And as the Christian sinner now follows Christ in the imitation of his suffering, in participating in this annihilation of self, being driven to the depths of despair, there at that moment he is close and closest to death to the mercy of the Heavenly Father. So German mysticism, at least as a kind of external catalytic, gave a kind of shape to the recovery side of the Tentatione. Now a fourth chapter, Augustinianism. The fifth one is going to be nominalism, and I better tell you that now, because what I have to say under number four is really intertwined with, it's interwoven with, the influence of nominalism upon Luther's discovery of the gospel. There's a very striking characteristic in Athanist theology about the way in which it conceived the meaning of sin. Sin in nominalist theology is not primarily the sin which we do. Sin is not defined primarily in terms of our behavior. It is that only secondarily. The determinative characteristic about a sinner's sin is what God adjudges it to be sin. Considered by itself, this is a very high biblical action. It would mean, for example, that in an atheistic universe, if there were no God, but even though men continued to be what they are, then it would follow that there would be no sin. People might still hate, cheat, lie, be loveless, and all the rest, but that isn't enough to make all this sinful. It is sinful finally only if God concurs in the judgment and says, I despise it, I reject it, and so on. I judge it as sinful. So there is this transcendent element in Athanist theology and its whole understanding of sin. But a sinner is a sinner because God adjudges him to be one. I thought I had said that I was going to talk about Augustinianism. Well, okay, I am. What I said about the nominalist view of the transcendent character of sin only sets us up now to say what kind of further contribution the Augustinianism added to Luther's concept of sin. Augustine also, of course, thought of sin in terms of the transcendent judgment of God, but sin is not God's chimera. For Augustine, sin is primarily a grievous injury, a vitium, a poisoning, a perversion right within the life of the sinner himself. It is the profound fault in the humanity of a man. The profound corruption of his human nature, and right imminently within his human nature. And this is one of the things that Luther took from Augustinianism and added it to the transcendent character of sin and nominalist theology. Sin is both simultaneously. It is a tremendous perversion of man as he was ideally created by God, and it is at the same time God conferring negative wrathful judgment against him. Now, the minute you add this Augustinian imminence to man's sin, you play hard with the next step in optimist theology. Because you'll recall, I said, that in the theology of the nominalist, even though sin may have been God's negative judgment against the man, still that man had within himself a measure of positive freedom to redeem his life before God, to do what in him lay, that was cut and so on. And if you made at least the modest effort that will require to transform himself, then it could be expected, that is, according to nominalist theology, that the judgment of God would turn from negative to positive in his favor. But now, if you add to this definition of sin, that man is so profoundly corrupted, so vitiated, by this deep-seated flaw, which is as deep-seated as his own nature is, then this belies the nominalist action on doing what in your life, so that door no longer stands open for you. And so you might say that Luther Augustinianized his optimist conception of sin. But this only made all human efforts at self-justification the more impossible. Now, on the other side, and we're still under number four, on the other side, Luther retained the optimist accent on the transcendent character of God's judgment when he moved into the area of God's grace. Here, what renders a man righteous is not primarily an inner transformation of his own sinful life, but what renders a man righteous, on the gospel side, is that God, in his overarching, his transcendent evaluation of man, declares a man to be righteous, to be pleasing to him, to be a delight to his fatherly heart. He is righteous essentially because God says he is. God chooses to regard him as such. And here you might say, perhaps at the risk of stretching it, that on the abiding insistence in Luther's theology upon what it is that makes a man righteous before God, namely that God in his grace reckons him righteous, you still see the echo of the old optimist accent on a man's being made to be what he is by virtue of what God regards him to be. Now, how about Augustinianism on this point? Augustine also said, of course, God's righteousness is omnipotent. And a man is righteous because God reckons him as such. But that isn't the end of the matter, Paul Augustine. With God's gracious predestination comes this miraculous, wondrous transformation of the man himself, which Augustine could explore in such moving phrases. But this element, this emphasis in Augustine, Luther somehow missed. Or perhaps he deliberately missed it. And you can't help but speculate, if Luther had taken that side of Augustine awfully seriously, that in order to be justified before God, a man must be righteously transformed within his own person, then one is tempted to think that Augustine would only have heightened, rather than lessened, Luther's grounds for despair. But what he does see in Augustine, on the gospel side, is the omnipotence of God's grace. God's grace is so all-powerful that it can overcome, it can tempt, it can negate his negative judgment against the sinner. And then Luther seems to self-pity the imminent factor in Augustine's theology that the righteous judgment of God must issue if it is going to be valid in the righteous transformation of the believer himself, so that only his righteousness will consist in his own new capacity to love God. Now, this does not sound true, so prominently in Luther, not on the doctrine of justification, but. And so you might say that if Luther Augustinianized his Aquinas conception of sin, on the other hand, he could have Aquinized, nominalize his Augustinian conception of God's grace. If the believer's righteousness before God stands with God's judgment of him as righteous, it does not stand or fall with his own righteous transformation of his life. As my sister, we've already said a lot about optimism. Let's add one point. The sister is I contend to say that optimism too, in other ways than we have already mentioned, provided a kind of catalyst for Luther's discovery of the gospel. And here the feature of nominalism that I have in mind is the nominalist accent upon scripture. God's special revelation of himself through the Holy Scriptures basis the impossibility of knowing God by means of rational reason. And having said this now, we set ourselves up for number six. And I really don't know whether I should include this in a list of the preceding five, because it almost seems to be different in kind from those preceding five catalysts. Maybe this isn't just a catalytic factor. Or what is it? It's the actual immersion of himself in the scriptures, which seems to have done more for precipitating Luther's discovery of the gospel than any of the preceding five factors may have. It's a real question among the Luther researchers just when Luther experienced the so-called power experience, just when and where, or at least just when it was that he made his breakthrough to the gospel. And partly that's a problem because he gives us two different conflicting accounts. But both of his accounts place the time of his discovery of the gospel in the period when he was lecturing on the books of scripture at the University of Wittenberg, and he directly connects his discovery of the gospel with this discovery which he made in the scriptures himself. Well, I guess we'll have to postpone the continuation until I reach the next number. And his Elector Frederick the Wise of Electoral Saxony, picked up the tab for his studies for the doctor. They're concerned about politics and things like that in those days too. Just a word in passing about the University of Wittenberg. It was only about a decade old at this time, and Luther got there. It was in about the most unlikely time that you could wish for a university to be. A very dirty, not very scenic town. And evidently about the only advantage which spoke in favor of erecting a university there was the feature of economy. It just so happened that for a long, long time before this, there had been a collegiate ecclesiastical foundation there, which was bringing in a tremendous revenue. It was a rather well-heeled foundation. And one of the great sideshows of this foundation was Elector Frederick's own collection of relics, the viewing of which brought much indulgence to those who made pilgrimage to these relics. So here is this monetary source, which made it a natural, fiscally that is, to build a university in connection with it. There was this revenue and the professorship that were established. Christian Finnegan, the professors were hired on as canons, this is a kind of legal fiction, as canons of the foundation. But they had virtually no pastoral responsibilities in connection with the foundation. In the surrounding parishes, for example, they would be provided with vicars, and that's what they were called. And the vicars did all the work, but the canons did all the income, as they say. And the vicars got the room and board, I guess, and money for smoke, but that's about it. At least that was the situation at first, in the early history of the University of Wittenberg. Another feature that you might bear in mind about this young struggling university, which was just a kind of nothing to begin with. It was a nothing, for example, in comparison with the University of Erfurt, an old, dignified university of long standing. And that was that because the University of Wittenberg had to establish its place in the sun, it evidently didn't find it worth the risk to adopt a single theological position for which it would stand, as for example Erfurt did. Erfurt was clearly a center of nominalistic theology. But at the University of Wittenberg, you had a variety of theological codes and views. Scopus himself very likely was not nominalist. Probably a Thomist with a heavy shading of German mysticism. And what we know about him. We do know that another one of Luther's colleagues there, Karl Stott, was an out-and-out chemist. So this made life interesting. Because in the future, the years to come, after the Reformation, the University of Wittenberg had all it could do to keep the students away. It became famous overnight. And largely because of the reputation of the only two men on its faculty. All right. Now, what did Luther do there? By way of his lectures? The first great series of lectures were his lectures on the Psalter, 1513 to 1515, the so-called Dictata Super Psalterium, the dictations on the Psalter. These were discovered, by the way, the manuscripts for these were discovered in 1874. And then after the lecture on the Psalms, the famous lecture on the Epistle of St. Paul to the Romans, 1515-1516. And this manuscript was discovered in 1899. See how recent it was. He lectured on Galatians in 1516. And this, by the way, was not the series of lectures on Galatians which you read last week. Actually, he lectured on Galatians 3 times in his professorial career. And the series which you read was his most mature series of lectures on that epistle given in 1531. But as a young budding professor of scripture, he lectured on Galatians in 1516. And then his lectures on Hebrews in 1517. The typical approach was the approach that Luther himself had been exposed to as a student and which he adopted as a teacher, was to distribute to the student an interlinear text of the scriptures with lots of room in the margins and lots of room between the lines. And then the instructor, who simply lectured, would dictate to his students material for them to put into the margins or between the lines. One of the common ingredients which he would dictate to them would be the so-called glossa, as we spoke about them before, the glosses. And these usually took the form of definitions. And you'll still find in Luther way at the end of his life, when he's lecturing in Genesis, for example, or for example, in your reading last week on Galatians, every now and then you'll find him saying, you recall to a student, a good and proper definition of Jesus Christ is, or a good and proper definition of a Christian is so-and-so, or a definition of sin is so-and-so, and you can just hear them stretching as a frivolous between the interlinear versions of Galatians. And another, a second ingredient in these exegetical lectures were the so-called scholia, S-C-H-O-L-I-A. Occasionally, when the exegete would come to a particularly fruitful verse, he would launch out on a long extended lecture on just that verse. And the student could take this all down almost verbatim. Let's stop and say in one sentence what Luther's stature seems to have been by this stage of the game. Pretty clear that he was, by this time, that is by 1515, 1516, he was the bright young lad, he was the pride and joy of the Augustinian order in Germany. It commanded a tremendous loyalty among the members of his order. He was the hometown boy who had made gifts. He said a lot of panic. Nobody there, so far as we can tell, ever thought of thinking of him as a reformer of the church, and perhaps he, least of all. And in addition, let's say too that for all of the prestige that he seemed to enjoy within the Augustinian order, he is by no means a celebrity nationally and certainly not internationally at this time. Well, we have the manuscript of these early lectures on the scriptures, Psalms, Romans, Galatians, Hebrews. As I mentioned, the manuscripts of some of them were discovered only very recently, close to the end of the previous century. When they were discovered, and this was probably the great impetus which launched what has since been called the new Luther Renaissance. The whole new look in Luther research got a tremendous shot in the arm from the discovery of these manuscripts, these early biblical lectures. And one of the points which was made resoundingly by the examination of these lectures was that it suddenly became clear what the real, shall I call it, the secret of the Reformation in fact was. The real secret of the Reformation was not Luther's battle against, let's say, the practice of selling indulgences. And it was not even his fight against the centralized power of Rome. But that the real secret of the Reformation, positively speaking, was basically a theological discovery about what makes the Christian gospel the Christian gospel. And that point, by the way, to generalize it for a moment, bring it up to date, that is a good point which Lutherans do well to remember in the current dialogue between, not between Protestants and Roman Catholics, but between Lutherans and Roman Catholics. As I find again and again in the course of this dialogue, the real rock of offense which divides us, that is, Lutherans and Roman Catholic Christians, isn't just the issue, as it might be, for example, between Roman Catholics and, let's say, the Reformed Christians. It isn't primarily the issue of authority. It isn't, for example, primarily the issue between scriptural authority versus the authority of the magisterium or the papacy. But the real rock of offense which divides us, and which in most places still hasn't even begun to be touched upon in the dialogue, is the basic soteriological question, which, to use the shorthand term, is the doctrine of justification. All right, part 5. Struggles in the monastery and the power experience. We haven't said it, and I suppose I should have reminded you, like a Greek chorus, like an old refrain, time and again, in the point I've made previously, that all the way through this period, at least from the time that Luther entered the monastery on upward, there are evidences of the tremendous unforeseen, the tentationes, we called them yesterday, with which and in which he was constantly hovering back and forth between life and death. That is, life and death in the only ultimate sense of those words. On the word tentatio or unforeseen, I suppose we can assume that they have become such common terms, even in their foreign versions, Latin or German, that it's hardly necessary to give them an English translation. The more important point, I guess, that is, even if it were necessary, there isn't one. To translate unforeseen literally as assault loses something, so it's within the translation. But it was the experience, finally, of being assaulted, shall we say, not only by one's own sin, but on account of one's sin, being assaulted by the devil, more than that, by the law, more than that, by the very law of God himself, by his truth. In the experience of which Luther said over and over again, a man feels that he has been divested, he has been stripped naked of every shred of righteousness to his name, so that he has not one thing on the strength of which he can stand boldly and confidently, carambola, before God. And if he has nothing of value by which he can count for anything at all before God, he has nothing on which to hang for dear life. And so everything goes dead in you, all comes to ashes, and the man is lost. Now, this is the sort of thing that negatively Luther was speaking about in his ancestors. He could put it much more graphically and vividly than I did. Let's ask to begin with, on the negative side, what can we say for sure? The negative explanation of these so-called struggles, these attacks, these unfestering, these contactions, what are, as far as the historical evidence can prove, are the explanations of the negative side of Luther's inner breakdown? one thing a historian certainly cannot overlook in trying to account for these modifying experiences. And by the way, if you get occasion to see Van Alden's play, Lucy, you see how this skinny dramatizer or contractor in the St. James Theatre off Broadway, as an experience. It gets just a little smelty, I'd say, and it pretty evidently was every bit as physical as Skinny portrayed it to be. So, one facet, though, which the historian cannot overlook, as a contributing factor, certainly not the sole explanation, but a contributing factor to the Contractionis, is the whole monastic way of life to which Luther had subjected himself. Monasticism, particularly in the lofty form in which Luther encountered it among the observance of the Augustinian Eremite, offered a promise of a way to perfection. Now, when we say perfection, now we ought to hasten to add that this did not mean, at least it did not mean literally, that here the candidate was offered a way to moral perfection so that finally he would be absolutely sinless. It was a basic plank in the platform of monasticism, indeed, that he could recognize to the day he died that he had fallen short of perfection. Now, Luther hardly needed to be told that. But it did offer a way to perfection, if by perfection what we mean is that there was at least a minimal offer, a minimal prospect of assurance, a peace of conscience, of the consolation of having been saved. Primarily through the special way, special discipline to which the monk subjected himself, and which the ordinary layman did not subject himself to, represented briefly by the threefold vow of chastity, obedience, and poverty, the keeping of the evangelical counsels, the high emphasis on searching out, rummaging around in his innards for every last vestige of false motives, of pride, of superbia, of libido, of lust and concupiscence and all the rest, and sweating them out, exposing them to his sight, and praying for the grace and the sacraments to extend him from his life. And then on the side of consolation, in this monastic way, there was always offered for the monk, who, having encountered this profound guilt within himself, would hear the word of consolation in the sacrament, in confession, absolution, and penance. Now, how is this a negative contributing factor to Luther's confession? Well, the promise of at least modest perfection, meaning by a modest assurance of the grace of God, turned out to have virtually the opposite effect for Luther. To put it briefly, the harder he tried, the harder he failed. And it wasn't that he couldn't live up to the evangelical counsels as well as the other monks could. He could say of himself as an Augustinian, like Saul could say of himself as a Pharisee, but he was a superlative monk. But that only aggravated the difficulty. And it wasn't only that the harder he tried, the more he found that there were things which he had left undone. That's often the picture we get. Let me just finish that sentence. It wasn't just that he always found there were still additional things which he had not yet done. But it was more profound than that. The harder he tried, the more he found that his eagerness to twist God down by his atonement, that very eagerness to win God's favor, was the very root and core of his difficulty. This is the subtlest pride of all. Perhaps the pride which says, God, I can never please you. And the awful temptation to be pleased with that. The fact that you can be so confoundedly displeased with yourself. But that at least God will love. He will love your flagellation of yourself. So, it was endemic, not an accident, but endemic to the very monastic piety itself to foster rather than to overcome and correct this high pride, this subtle superior, which drove a man away from God rather than to him. Okay, let's pick up here tomorrow. Thank you.